Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Our guest today recently retired after 20 years of service with Gainesville Fire Rescue in Florida, where he was most recently the district chief. He's been a volunteer firefighter, a call taker and dispatcher, and an EFDQ, and now he works full-time as an instructor for priority dispatch. He recently graduated from the Executive Fire Officer Program at the National Fire Academy, where he conducted a research study we're going to talk about today. So welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Before we dive into your study then, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your career? How did you first get into the fire service, and what was the path that led you up to district chief?
Well, interestingly enough, I was a student at the University of Florida and ran into an old high school colleague of mine who had a little pamphlet sticking out of her book bag that said she was part of what's called the Fire Rescue Association, which at the time was a student organization of Gainesville Fire Rescue. That's kind of where I got started with it. Graduated, left, was in a different career, and decided I wanted to pursue it, fire service specifically, and went back home and got certified, was a volunteer down there, and was lucky enough to get hired back with the City of Gainesville just a short 2 years later.
And then did you end up being a Q through work in the comm center, or did you end up doing that as an instructor, or how did that happen?
So we recently implemented EFD at Gainesville Fire Rescue, and actually our PSAP is a multi-jurisdictional PSAP as well. So between the City of Gainesville and Electric County Fire Rescue, we implemented the process and the protocols, and we're an ACE center for EMD, and obviously we have an interest in becoming ACE for fire. So the PSAP approached me separately from my work to see if I'd be interested in working part-time with them to assist in that process.
Interesting. You recently graduated from the Executive Fire Officer Program at the National Fire Academy. By the way, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What are the research requirements? I've heard that there's a pretty substantial research requirement for that Executive Fire Officer Program. What are the research requirements there?
Well, the program itself is a four-year program that's conducted on-site in Emmitsburg, Maryland. And at the end of each of the four classes, you're required to do what's called an applied research paper. And that paper is a research paper that's required to be affiliated with not only the field of fire rescue, but something directly related to your agency. And each of the 4 years has kind of a specialty, if you will, associated with it. And so as part of that specialty, you can just design or identify, maybe it's a better choice of words, identify a need that your agency has. And then you do the research to identify what would be either a solution for that need. Sometimes the research might simply be to identify what actually the need is. And that's the basics of the program.
That's very interesting that they don't just have you do a sort of general or foundational research study. They actually ask you to go back to your own agency and conduct the research there. So what was your topic, or what was the need that you were looking to fulfill there in your agency?
Well, for the most recent one, it was associated with the NFPA 1221 standard and the time constraints that are associated with that with regards to dispatching calls. I had previously, in my first year, had actually done a similar study, but focused more on just how long it was taking our PSAP to actually just process calls. At the time, we were going for accreditation, the fire department was, for the first time. And we were successful, but one of the concerns that they had was how long it was taking to process fire calls. And so as part of that research, that initial research was to identify what the previous fire chief liked to call, what were the bends in the pipes that we could straighten out and streamline and make the process more efficient. And we were able to do so. But then once we implemented EFD, the times increased, and expectedly. Now we were concerned about how that would affect our reaccreditation process. So the research was to look at, if possible, kind of more of a broader stroke, not just internally, but a broader stroke. What are expectations for other agencies? How are they handling this? If they're accredited, how are they meeting it? And what are their overall times? And compare that to my PSAP and then present that paper.
So you broadened the scope so that you weren't just looking at the times in your own center. You were looking at how you stack up or compare to other agencies that are using the same protocol system?
Correct.
I know that you've mentioned that the NFPA standard, it's the only existing standard, but there's some talk about the fact that they're not particularly evidence-based. It's more of a, I guess, a goal standard, a standard that we're trying to reach that we don't really know whether people are, whether that's a realistic standard. And I think that was part of the impetus behind your study. If so, what do you think you found out about that?
Yeah, most definitely it was. You know, I mean, as my understanding of the NFPA standards, there is not a specific research, a lot of anecdotal data, a lot of, you know, thoughts, and a lot of good folks that are trying to identify what they think is best practices. Mm-hmm. What was challenging, and not unexpectedly, but what was challenging is the fact that we, between different CAD systems and different dispatch models, meaning how do you actually dispatch the fire rescue units, creates a real challenge. And it was a challenge for this research project as well. It actually limited my ability to get as much data as I was hoping to, because trying to actually correlate that data from ProQA to your CAD data so that we can get a realistic time, because NFPA says from phone pickup until notification of fire units, and that's your time frame. Not every agency measures their call processing from the same time standard. Mm. Some do it from phone pickup. Some do it from first keystroke. Others are secondary PSAPs. And so, you know, there's that loss of the primary PSAP component to it. So, you know, it's a lot easier for them to meet that standard because that information is already being gathered. And then on the back end of it, how do you actually dispatch? What I did find was that there's a lot of time on the front end where call takers are having to get things like, and this is making assumptions based on my own PSAP, but you know, the times seem to match other agencies, is that you know, the front end of it, before you even get to, okay, tell me exactly what happened, there's a lot of delay there.
One of the things that a standard is for is to set best practices. And you talked about how there are a lot of people who have a lot of experience in this field who are involved in the development of the standard. And it tends to be somewhat consensus-based or driven by anecdote, as you said. Mm-hmm. But the goal is always to drive best practice when we set a standard like that. And I know one of the concerns that's been raised, and in fact, another researcher that we're working with has raised this question in a project recently, is whether these kinds of potentially, maybe not unrealistic, but idealistic time standards are driving people to do things that might not be best practice. And then specifically, I'm talking about pre-alerting. So I know a lot of people use pre-alerting as a way to meet the standard so that as soon as they have a call come in, they pre-alert, which can kind of stop the clock. They can count that as their dispatch point before they gather a lot of information. Did you see any of that in your study, or have you seen that?
So there were some agencies that did indicate that they did a pre-alert, and certainly that, for lack of a better word, you know, skewed the times, you know, if you look at it from a global perspective. But, you know, I do find that when you talk to these agencies or those who, you know, debate between are they going to do a pre-alert or not, certainly you're meeting the time standard, but is that really the best for the citizens? You know, are you willing to upgrade and downgrade? You know, because are you going to send too much out the gate to make sure that you've got everybody going? Or are you going to just send a single unit and then add additional units later? The accreditation, for example, not only has a time component associated just with the call processing, but it also has a time component associated with getting all the units there To actually handle that structure fire call. And their biggest one is structure fire. So, you know, it's not just, okay, how quickly did you get them out? Is how quickly did you get everybody there? So if you are willing to do a pre-alert and send a full complement out the gate, and then afterwards you find out that, oh, actually this was just an odor call, or the fire is actually out, are we really doing the best thing for our citizens? And so that's a struggle that agencies are certainly having to balance and weigh against the NFPA expectations.
And of course, that ends up being a resource issue as well. If you send out a large complement of responders to an incident, then first of all, those aren't available to respond anywhere else, but also that can be very expensive, right?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, certainly anytime you start a truck, there's a dollar fixture to that immediately, you know, just the wear and tear on the apparatus, the use of the fuel. And then, of course, you know, the potential for emergency vehicle collisions and mm-hmm. getting them on the road and having all these folks going lights and sirens when if you know ahead of time, you know, or if you just waited that extra minute, you know, to allow the call taker to actually get more reliable and most up to date information to say, oh, wait a minute, actually, this is a fire out. And maybe for a fire out call, you don't send, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 units or whatever your particular jurisdiction decides on, and maybe you only send one or two. You know, got all these vehicles on the road, you have the cost expense to it, and like you said, now you have tied up other resources that may not be or are not available for another call that may come in.
Given all of these interesting complexities then, and it seems like this is kind of a subtle question in terms of balancing your different priorities as an agency, what do you think was your main finding or your main takeaway for yourself and your agency and possibly for other agencies who might be listening from the study that you did?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway that I found was certainly that the times that these agencies are using the protocol as it's designed in an effort to provide the best level of care for their citizens, you will not be able to meet the NFPA standards. Mm-hmm. I think it would be not impossible, but from a 90th percentile consideration, I think it would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to actually meet. Even just at my own agency, we've identified certain individuals that are just very quick, but it doesn't matter how quick they are if they're struggling with the getting the right location from the caller. And so that's something that's out of our hands. And granted, that's supposedly part of the time frame in place. And matter of fact, you know, NFPA even has a couple little flexibility for that. But it's still not enough. And I think that's the main takeaway is that, you know, even though I have a limited amount of data and I would certainly love to be able to get more data out there to be able to, you know, look at it from a more global scale. And the agencies I looked at were not local to the state of Florida, for example. I got them from several different, you know, states. So, you know, it was something from around the country. Some were volunteer departments, some were paid departments, some pre-alert, some did not. Some had automated systems like my agency does for dispatching, and then others had the Motorola system. So with the wide variety of systems in place, I still found that the timeframes, no matter where you fell in that spectrum of different technologies and policy decisions, you would not be able to meet the NFPA standard without doing the pre-alert. And at that point, then it's really the question of, is that the best practice for your, you know, jurisdiction? Is that what's most important, to just meet that time standard? Or is it to get more quality information from your callers so you're sending the right resources out at the right time as needed?
And just from your own perspective, having looked into this question for several years now, do you have a sense of where you come down on that question?
Oh, personally, yeah, no, I'm most definitely of the non pre-alert camp. So I personally feel that the amount of time that it takes for us to gather some additional information has far too many benefits and outweighs the what I consider a relatively small amount of time savings by doing the pre-alert. I think you have, for all the reasons that we've already mentioned, certainly additional resources on the road, tying them up. But I also think there's, you know, there's a morale issue of the crews. You know, when that tone goes off, or is it going to be the boy that cried wolf syndrome? Oh, we heard it again, you know, but man, we get downgraded so many times because, you know, they finally, a minute or two later, they get more information. And so does that translate into a performance issue and complacency? And then again, from a citizen's perspective, the one who's having the emergency, we might get there quicker, but are we interfering or potentially causing more harm to the rest of the citizens, whether it's due to a potential vehicle collision or a resource management issue, and is that really the best course? Personally, I don't think it is.
This gets then at a bigger question in the fire service, and I think we're seeing this in EMS and to some extent in police work as well, that we're moving from more of a consensus-based standards development practice to more of an evidence-based practice. So it sounds to me like the fire service is just becoming more data-driven in general. There are a lot more legislatures, a lot more jurisdictions asking for quantitative reporting, for insight into outcomes. So why do you think there's been this change toward more evidence-based or data analysis-based practice? And where do you see that going in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you think are the questions that are going to be important for the fire service?
Wow. Well, you know, I think the challenge for us to, you know, have gotten where we were to where we are now is, you know, the old adage of, you know, fire department is 100 years of tradition unimpeded by progress. And I think what has changed, in answer to your question specifically, is that more folks are going to places like the National Fire Academy, as well as just getting, you know, educated better on, okay, well, is this really the best practice for us? And should we be just continuing doing what we've always been doing because that's just the way we've always been doing business? So I think we're getting a new core of fire officers and as well as chief officers who are recognizing that and are willing to get outside their comfort zone and say, okay, you know what? Maybe we should try something different. And I know it was a, just, you know, even internally at my own agency, it was a big step for us to change our response. For example, we had a full complement, if you will, for the fire out calls, as well as the appliance fire calls. And I was able to actually go back and look at our data and showed that in 100% of cases, when we had the right information from the call taker, we, and this was prior to EFD, but just in our old system, we didn't need to send a full complement. You know, there was data to justify that, hey, you know what, we can reduce this from an 8 or 9 unit response down to a 2 unit response. And we've been successfully doing that ever since. So those fire chiefs who are willing to listen to that and take advantage of the data that's there certainly is a bold step. I probably think there's also a dynamic of we haven't been very good about collecting data. You know, we've done our, you know, reports and that kind of thing, but really in terms of putting it together and having somebody to analyze it, that's not really, you know, the bread and butter of the fire service. And so more and more agencies are tapping into, you know, IT resources and analysts who are able to actually do something more than just say, yep, here's a report that you're handing off to, you know, some state agency or something like that. No, this is actually how you're doing and what are you willing to measure these things? And if so, you know, where do you want to go from there? And so I think that's probably the biggest change that we've seen recently. As to where we go in the future, you know, there's a lot of interesting technology out there. You know, there's a big push right now, you know, for getting more real-time data. And so you have, you know, whether it's from, you know, on the 911 center side where it's next-gen 911 and we're getting some, you know, video recordings there, or is it a scenario where we're using, you know, drones and or other technology that is on scene that allows the incident commanders more real-time knowledge to be able to handle either both the small scale as well as the large scale incidents. And then furthermore, I would hope that agencies and fire chiefs would certainly look at their, you know, demographic information and call volume information and certainly utilizing that more strategically for resource management, for staffing levels, for equipment needs. Our service has changed and continues to change, certainly since, you know, 9/11 and the Columbine incident and the active shooter scenarios that we've been having, you know, how we do business is constantly being reevaluated. And in the world of, you know, social media and everyone has a cell phone and is recording things, we have to be more cognizant, I guess, if you will, of what's going on around us and recognize that the public's going to be more, has a more critical eye to how we've been doing business in the past.
So there's more visibility, more transparency into what the fire service is doing.
Yeah, definitely. Which is not a bad thing. So,
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I would like to ask you one more question, which is, you said that you were the liaison between your fire department and the comm center. Do you have any ideas or suggestions for better communication, better collaboration between communication centers and fire agencies so that we can make some of these improvements across the board and work together?
Yeah, you know... It's interesting as I go around the country and talk to agencies and how they're doing business, and where some agencies have really embraced the concept of dispatch review committees and steering committees. But man, the more you can get folks involved in the process and understand what's going on. I had a great conversation today with a training officer about, you know, how someone who transitioned, for example, from a 911 center and then they take a position in the road, how they're more in tune to how the process works. Mm-hmm. They're just one cog of the wheel, but now they know two cogs of the wheel and two very important cogs of the wheel. And while there certainly are other components, technology and, you know, emergency management and et cetera, the fact that these two so closely work together certainly should encourage agencies to say, hey, look, this doesn't need to be just at the top. You need to have folks who are at the operations level, who are, you know, on the streets, who are going to ask the questions, and then they become more knowledgeable. And to me, I believe that the concept of knowledge is power is good, but it also just really underscores the benefit of knowing how the other side works and being able to make sure you say, okay, well, I'm having this challenge and I'm getting it, you know, this is what I'm hearing from you. How can we work together to find a common solution? And if it's constantly just from a top, as opposed to, you know, at the mid-management level and or at the field level, I think there's going to be continued disconnect. So the more you can get folks involved, while I certainly appreciate that takes time and everybody's time is certainly valuable, I think overall the long-term benefit is worth it.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invite.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.